This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm going to be reading for the third and final time Sumner Madison's chapter about his friend Sigurd Olsen. This reading takes place in 1979, and this is from Sumner's book of Field. Sumner's last name, by the way, is spelled M-A-T-T-E-S-O-N. We are at Listening Point with Sig, and they've just been for a swim. After a few minutes of silence, I asked him about his earliest recollections of the Quetico Superior. An easy question to answer, he says. During the First World War, which I was in briefly, I lived in Ashland. I'd always heard of that beautiful country across Lake Superior from the Apostle Islands, along the famous North Shore. And I'd always had a yen inside of me to get over there. In 1916, 17, and 18, I'd canoed all around Ashland and used to keep a canoe down at the waterfront near Fish Creek Slough. Sometimes I would canoe out to Long Island at the head of Chequamegon Bay. I also used to canoe the White River, the Bras Brule, the Namekagon, and at that time the Namekagon was boiling with brook trout. Nowadays, you hardly catch a brook. They're all browns. Eventually, I went to the Quetico Superior in 1920 after graduating from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I taught high school in Nashwauk, Minnesota, a small mining town in the northeast corner of the state, and spent my free time exploring rivers and lakes around the area. I immediately fell in love with this country and decided that this was where I was going to live. I began to cruise around the area on my own and finally learned the country well enough to become a guide in 1923. I guided parties without knowing most of the country. There were big sections of the area that weren't mapped. I often had to climb a tree, spot some blue, cut out a portage, and keep on going. That was the way most of this country was mapped before aerial surveys. In my early days of guiding, I dreamt of emulating the feats of older guides who had been to Hudson Bay. Hudson Bay was an impossible dream to me. But eventually, I went a lot further than any of them had ever dreamed of going. I came to know the whole North, including the Yukon and Alaska. But I no sooner got up here than I got involved in the preservation of this wilderness from the 1920s to the present. I remember the 1920s well. In the early years of that decade, the Forest Service had a plan to build a series of roads into all the border lakes, and that's when I first got involved. The Ely Chamber of Commerce and all the chambers of commerce across northern Minnesota trumpeted the slogan, "Let's make this country the playground of the nation." Well, I was guiding at the time, and I didn't spend much time thinking about the concept of wilderness. But I did have a strong feeling about wild country, and it disturbed me to think that if they built a road up to Basswood Lake, up to Crooked Lake, Lake La Croix, Saginaw's lakes, the wilderness would be ruined. It would be gone. And I had enough perception to realize that if the wilderness disappeared, I would lose something very precious to me. Those old men at the Chamber of Commerce in Ely, they were probably in their 30s or 40s. I thought I was crazy, absolutely insane. Why on earth could I object to bringing prosperity to the country and really making it the playground of the nation? I tried to explain in my faltering way. I hadn't yet formulated my concept of wilderness, why wilderness in time might help the local economy. They couldn't understand. In 1922, with the battle beginning to rage over the roads issue, I met a young forester by the name of Arthur Carhart. He was the first landscape architect employed by the Forest Service. I met him up on Saginaw's one night, and we had a long talk. He had not seen the country before and was enthralled by it. He came back from that trip and met with the Ely Chamber of Commerce and told them that the best thing they could do was to keep this land in its wild state and not build any roads. and he recommended to the Forest Service that they abandon their project. And they had $50,000 put aside to build all these roads, and they finally canceled the project. The reaction? The old diehards here in Ely thought I had ruined the country. That was the beginning of my demise as a citizen. The Secretary of the Forest Service in 1926, William Jardine, signed a proclamation designating the areas in question as the roadless areas, into which there were to be no roads. You could hunt, fish, cut timber, use motorboats, and so on, but it was a primitive area, and a primitive area it was supposed to remain. It went through a whole series of names. Once it was called the Superior Primitive Area, then the Roadless Areas, then the Boundary Waters Canoe Area in 1968, and finally the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness in 1978. The important designation here is the word wilderness. Wilderness was a growing concept for me. I gradually became aware of its importance to posterity, and I gradually became aware of developing a spiritual relationship to land, as Native Americans did and have done for centuries. Everything they have comes from the land, and they feel they must use its resources and never waste them. That's the way I feel about the land, and the land belongs to God. Therefore, we cannot hurt the land without hurting our relationship to God. And so when it comes to the matter of wilderness, wilderness being what the land originally was before we desecrated it, we are trying to preserve the purity of the land as God intended it for our spiritual welfare as well as for our psychological well-being. We belong to the land, and we cannot divorce ourselves from it. When you divorce yourself from the land, you cut your roots. Those who cut their roots are lost souls, and the world is full of them, grasping, looking desperately for something to hold on to. If they would only realize that all they have to do is feel one with the land and feel one with God, they're one and the same thing. So wilderness, too, is a state of mind. You can find it even in small areas, such as in a city park screened from traffic. Once there, if you're in the proper state of mind, you'll discover your wilderness. Gusts of wind swept across the bay, and Sig intently watches the clouds drift overhead. Talk turns to his final days as a guide and the decision to sell his Border Lakes Outfitting Company in Winton, Minnesota. I sold out my interest for peanuts because I wanted to counter the criticism that I had made money off the wilderness, so why shouldn't everybody else? I can still see the fingers pointing at me. You're making all your money off this, of course you want to preserve it. So to counter that, I sold my business for $5,000, which was ridiculous. I could have gotten $100,000 or $200,000 if I had waited a few years. But I wanted to be clean. I wanted to be out of it, and I got out of it, and I shut the mouths of those who had been criticizing me. The most rabid critics said, "You damn fool, what'd you do that for?" Well, I said I had to get out of it. They replied, "You're crazy." He laughs quietly and shakes his head at this no-win situation. Then he looks up at the sky. "Is that thunder?" He suggests we move to the cabin. Once inside, he lies down on the bed against the north wall, his hands behind his head. Lake breezes greet us with fresh pine scents. Let me tell you a little about the battle to ban aircraft from the roadless areas after World War II, he begins. Pilots came in from the war to discover that every lake here was like a landing field. There were planes in here all the time, and the work that we had done up to that time to preserve the Quetico Superior was threatened by the airplanes and fly-in resorts in both Canada and the U.S. Well, what were we to do about it? The Quetico Superior Committee sent me down to Washington to look up the Air Commerce Act of 1926 to see if there was anything that could be used as a key to the situation. Nobody had ever controlled private aircraft over the country. Well, I found that under Section 4 of the Act, the President of the United States had the power to establish an airspace reservation for national defense, government installations, and so on, and for other governmental purposes. I read that last part of that line with delight. I discovered that other governmental purposes was a determination for which the United States had spent money. Fine. We could show that from Teddy Roosevelt's proclamation of the Superior National Forest in 1909 up to the recently passed Thy-Blatnick Act of 1948, which gave the Forest Service the power to purchase recreational lands for wilderness protection, there had been a consistent government record to protect the roadless areas. I went to President Truman's staff and asked them if it was possible to get an executive order on the matter. They said, sure, and drafted the order. The order gave the president the power to establish an airspace reservation over this area for the protection of wilderness. Then the big question was whether we could have the executive order signed. It had to be signed by at least 6 cabinet members. So it was sent out to the cabinet members, but nothing happened. I didn't hear any more about it. Russell Andrews, a friend of mine and an assistant to Truman, was getting worried. He said, let's sit down and call all the departments and see where this thing is. It's been lost somewhere. We spent a whole day looking for the damn thing. No soap. Then it was discovered that the Secretary of Commerce was still to be heard from. Well, Russ had a hunch that it was probably on some underling's desk in the Department of Commerce and told me he was going to go over there personally. There it was, on an undersecretary's desk under a pile of stuff about a foot high. Russ brought it back to the White House, and I looked at it with awe and delight. We started the calls all over again, and this time Russ had it hand-carried around all the departments until finally it came back to the president. Truman was just about to leave office. He was busier than hell. He had all kinds of things to take care of before he got out of office. So he went to his favorite summer place in Key West, Florida. That was before the days of San Clemente. It was just a simple little place. Russ went down there with him and the precious signed document. And on the last day before Truman came back up to Washington, Russ waited for him as he came off the beach wrapped in his towel. The president was dripping wet. Russ handed him the document and Truman said, well, what's this? Russ told him it was about the Superior National Forest, and the president said, oh yeah, I know all about this. This is the battle between the beaver and the airplane pilots. Well, he said, let's give it to the beaver, and he signed it right there. That's the famous airspace reservation of 1949. There have been so many battles over the years that I'm glad we finally got the law in 1978 establishing the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. It's a much better wilderness than any of the Quetico Superior Committee had envisioned that would have included motorboats, cutting of timber, mining, snowmobiles, and more. Our bill wasn't perfect, but darn near. It has phased out periods on various snowmobile and motorboat routes. So in 5 years, about 1,250,000 acres will be all wilderness, no mechanized uses. As far as the Canadians are concerned, they have stopped all motorboats and snowmobile traffic in Quetico Provincial Park, located adjacent to Superior National Forest in Ontario, established in 1913. As of May 5, 1979, there's no mining, no logging, nothing. It's a wilderness park. I met with the Canadian Quetico Superior Committee in the spring of 1979, and they and the Prime Minister reaffirmed the Quetico Park would remain a wilderness park. The Canadians have enlarged the park by 250,000 acres on the east side and have added great wilderness chunks near the Lake of the Woods. You know, a lot of us wanted a treaty between the United States and Canada protecting the Quetico Superior region. I spent almost 15 years trying to secure such a treaty. But the original treaty precepts are not as all-inclusive as the provisions of the law we have today. I once was bitter about not getting a treaty, but events have worked out pretty well. Unfortunately, there will never be completion of the work to preserve the Quetico Superior. The old opponents of the new law are going to sue the government, saying that the law is unconstitutional. they threatened to go through all the court procedures, not realizing that to reach the Supreme Court today will cost them millions of dollars. Furthermore, Congress will not retrace its steps. The legislative process has acted, and all the agony of getting this measure through is over with. I'm happy with it, but nothing is perfect. It seems that the battle will always rage. The future looks pretty good, except that there are too many people, but I don't know what you can do about that. The only hope lies in the fact that there's more canoe country to the north, far more than there is here. It's most difficult to get to and harder to travel. The Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness is cursed with easy accessibility and ease of travel, short portages and long chains of lakes. And like many vulnerable areas, it's beautiful. You won't find this kind of beauty in the far north. You won't find towering red and white pines and beautiful campsites on rocky ledges like you have here. But the north has its advantages in its tremendous space and solitude. Sig sits up as he speaks and then says, "We should sit on the cedar bench outside the west window to catch the sunset. Black-gray clouds hide all but slashes of golden light along the horizon to the west. Islands appear as moles to the far west." Sig's attention turns briefly to the subject of wilderness management. The concept of multiple-use management is not compatible with the concept of wilderness management. The use of wilderness means no multiple use. Wilderness can only have one use, enjoyment for itself. As we look ahead 10 to 20 years, this land will be more beautiful than ever. The results of fire and logging are still evident, but everything is coming back. This little place here was logged and burned about 1890. And now look how big the trees are now. Give them another 100 years, and it will look like a virgin forest. I'll never live to see it, but of course somebody will. Across the lake, a cloud has broken from the rest and carries sheets of rainwater toward us. I can't feel or hear any wind, and the noise of rain on the still lake is strangely loud, almost like the muted sound of gravel poured from a distant barrel. I ask Sigurd if he hears it. At first he doesn't respond, but tilting his head in the direction I'm pointing, he rises excited. "Ah, let's go and watch it." About 200 meters to the southwest, a rain curtain moves in our direction. Closer and closer it comes. "Sounds like an express train in a subway," he says, chuckling. 75 meters, 50 meters, still we are dry. Right up to our feet roll beads of rainwater. Instantly we feel cool droplets. In seconds the shower passes by and continues inland as it taps across the woodland canopy. To the west, long strands of sunlight stretch across the water. "Listen," whispers Sig. Near the center of the lake, a common loon calls, a mournful, slow, hypnotic wailing. Then Elizabeth, his devoted and tireless wife, too, calls. She has arrived with dinner. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.